welcome back to another special episode of the Epic Experiment Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce, and I'm joined on the line by Lux. What's new, my friend?
Not much. And just enjoying the cool weather that's finally coming in, like starting to move away from the hot temperatures.
Okay. I live in Canada. What do you mean by cool temperatures? Because like I got cool and you got cool. Like, what are we talking about?
Well, for me, and cool would be anything under 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Jesus. Okay, so what did you reach for a daytime high today in the grand city of Burleson, Texas?
And I think the highest we reached today was 67 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yikes. Okay, so comparison, listeners. Today here in Eastern Ontario of Canada, we hit a grand high, I think, of 5 degrees Celsius, which is somewhere in the mid-40s, I think. And it rained, and it was cold. So you went outside today, bundle up, and let me assure you, we ain't done yet. It's going to get colder, and it's going to get better. It's so much better. Oh, boy. And then on top of it, Lux, it's so dark and gloomy. Like, the sun sets so early and rises so late in the day. It's awful. Like, it's just the worst. Ugh. Anyway. Otherwise, what else is shaking? You doing good?
And I am. And I recently opened a collector's booster from Zendikar Rising.
And what did you get? Did you get something spicy?
And the spiciest hit that I got was a foil and a showcase. Not showcase, but it's extended art to Thieving Skydiver.
Thieving Skydiver? Hold on a second. I'm not familiar with Thieving Skydiver offhand. I want to be. It sounds like a cool card. And if it's like the fun Thieving Skydiver. Where does this one go? Oh, this one. Oh, it's the one that steals like mana rocks and stuff. Oh, that's cool. So one in a blue for a 2/1 with flying. When Thieving Skydiver enters the battlefield, if it was kicked, and you can kick it for X. Gain control of target artifact with converted mana cost X or less. If that artifact is an equipment, attach it to Thieving Skydiver. So I'm guessing you're just looking to steal mana rocks with this guy.
Yeah, but of course, with it being in $11, I really don't think this is all that big of a hit since I paid $30 for the booster.
No, you didn't make money back on that particular single card on all alone. However, hopefully the contents of the remainder of the pack might have did you well, but you never know.
And I got one card that I was after. I got Yasharn.
Oh, that's cool. Is it in foil or?
No, it was one of the non-foils.
Well, that happens too. So anyway, well, that's good. That's a good card. I like Yasharn's cool. I like that guy.
Yeah, like this one, I didn't really care if it was foil or not because it's a card that I actually plan on running in a deck.
Oh, for sure. Like you put that in a deck and you just rock it and just be enjoy it. So sounds good. So tonight we're also being joined on the line by a friend of the show. Someone who's actually been very gracious in the past and donated a child of Alara to send away and be banished to somewhere else in the world. We have Nick joining us. Nick, how are you tonight?
I am doing well, and I'm rather excited to be on the podcast. Thanks for having me on.
Well, very happy to have you on. So Nick had reached out to me and had some excellent ideas he wanted to discuss on the show. And I wanted to squeeze him in before Commander Legends spoils pop up in a week or two. Because I'm pretty sure once Commander Legends like hits like the internet, it's going to be all over the place. And that's all we're going to want to talk about. So I thought we should squeeze him in before we get into some of that craziness. So glad to have Nick on the show tonight. So just a reminder there, everybody, if you want to catch this week's show or next week's show or last week's show or any show really that we put out, go to check out thelotuscouncil.com. That's our home on the internet, and you can find us there. That's where the podcast is, but they also have got a very happening Discord, lots of other great content over there too, some Jank Mander stuff with Sona, who was on with us last week for Brawl. You've got some finance stuff with Patrick, and you've got some Wow, who's on the Twitch, getting the Twitch stream going. So If you guys want to check them out, they've got a little bit of everything for everyone. So come and check them out. Another big thank you goes out to the people organizing the third annual 31 Days of Christmas. That is going on again this year. We are very thankful here on the podcast to be on board and participating in this great giveaway. So if you have not seen this before, for the entire month of December, all 31 days, different content creators are going to be essentially giving away stuff of all sorts, shapes and sizes. Some of it sponsored by, you know, bigger people, let's say, than just our podcast. I saw some stores that people might recognize and some other podcasts and other creators that people might know. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're very happy to be on board and participating. Isn't that right, Lux?
Oh, definitely.
It's a good time, and we're very, very, very much looking forward to being part of it. So tonight we're going to open up with Garbage or Great, and for those of you at home playing along with us, we are going to be looking at a card generated by Scryfall's random card generator, and then ascertaining if we think the card might be garbage or if the card might be great. And tonight should be reasonably straightforward, I think, because we have, drumroll please, Duretti Scrap Savant. So Duretti is a planeswalker for 3 and a red. You get planeswalker Duretti, and he has got 3 loyalty when he enters the battlefield. For +2, discard up to 2 cards, then draw that many cards. -2, sacrifice an artifact. If you do, return target artifact from your graveyard to the battlefield. And you get his -10 is you get an emblem with whenever an artifact is put into your graveyard from the battlefield, return that card to the battlefield at the beginning of the next end step. And it says Duretti Scrap Savant can be your commander. So what do we think? Lux, I'm gonna do first crack. Duretti. Garbage? Great. Go.
You're really putting me on the spot here, because honestly, I'm really having a hard time deciding.
Okay, that's fair. Allow me then. This is great. This is a great card because this is just a combo piece for mono red or red based artifact decks, and there's no part of this that you don't want to do. All right, it's going to go right in. You're going to go right in your yard and dig up all sorts of shenanigans with it. You've got some card filtering with that +2, and like you play this on whatever turn, and it immediately goes to 5 loyalty. 5 loyalty is not an insignificant amount of loyalty to knock off a planeswalker. Yes, it can be done in Commander. Don't get me wrong, but if you set up any sort of landmines to get in the way, then Duretti is going to start generating you some significant advantage. And then the -2, sack an artifact and then return another artifact for your graveyard to the battlefield. That's crazy. You sack your food token and you can go and get your Mere Battlesphere back out of your graveyard. Come on. Tell me that isn't exciting. That is crazy good. And then -10, you get an emblem. Whenever an artifact is put into your graveyard for the battlefield, you just get it straight back. That sort of emblem is just how you create wild value loops of all sorts of shenanigans. So I think this guy is pretty bananas. Like, do you want him necessarily as your commander? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. I've seen him do good work and have decks be really, really janky all around him. But while they're janky, they're still scary good. You can do, like, there's just unappreciated cards that suddenly become ferocious monsters. You're like, oh, I hadn't banked on losing to this deck tonight. So it is really good. I'm all in on Duretti. I think this guy's great. So we'll give him Lux a minute there. Nick, do you have an opinion on Mr. Duretti, the Scrap Savant?
I think Duretti is, if you ignore the last line of text, fantastic. The lack of color access to, like you said, he wants to do combo-y things and just go bananas. And without towing at least blue or blue and black or blue and white, he doesn't have as much to make the combos really, really go. And so I think in the 99, great. And it may just be my own desire to not play a mono-colored deck, but as the commander, I'd say garbage.
Well, okay. I can, maybe as the commander, he's garbage, but I think...
In the 99? Oh, it's good.
He's gas. Like, he's gas. Oh, yeah. But I can appreciate not wanting to be pigeonholed into mono-red. Like, I can get that. I can get behind that. Yeah. All right, Lux, your turn. What do you think?
Well, and I listened to both of you, and honestly, like, the one thing about him that really stands out to me that makes me think he's great is that ultimate, because let me tell you, that honestly scares me. Like, and say that, you know, like, your opponent has something like Winter Orb, then you're able to get rid of it.
Not anymore. You can't do it now. You're just going to die to it. Yeah, yeah, no, like,
that's
sure.
Honestly what's
aim.
Yeah, really. Like, that's what scares me about it.
If
is
you
that,
can't
like,
find a loop that wins.
Yeah, like, okay, that's the thing with this sort of emblem. Like, I'm almost kind of the opinion that emblems are almost unfair, and I wish they would move away from them or give us a way to interact with them. That's what I hope. Like, somewhere down the line, they give us the ability to interact with them, because they're so breaking, like, backbreaking when someone can get them. Like, I agree. Like, if this gets to emblem, this has gone from 3 loyalty to you're getting having to have 4 consecutive turns to get this to like 10 plus. Like, if this hasn't died in 4 turns, there's a problem, right? But I still, like, if you can, like, that emblem is so backbreaking. I would love to have some way to interact with it. Like, just because otherwise you're like everyone's agreeing here. We are going to die to that emblem. Like, that emblem is nuts.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, it's like, as a better example, and they, what if someone's using the Aetherflux Reservoir in a combo, and, like, they're about to just completely, and they knock you out of the game. Like, you're managed to remove Aetherflux Reservoir from the game, and then it just comes back.
Yeah. Like, it's just, and that's like the tip of the iceberg. Like, I, like, that is really, like, on the grand scheme of things, reasonably modest in terms of aspirations with that. So yeah, like, you now protect your ridiculous board state. Mere Battlesphere is just like Mere Battlesphere. This thing is just a menace, like just an absolute menace. Having seen that and played that and died to that, it is terrifying. So yeah, no, I'm a big fan. So, okay. So we all agree in the 99, wild good, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Lux, you?
And I think it's great.
Okay, now, let's go. Commander, are we less excited for it as a commander?
And I'm, as a commander, I'm just not feeling it.
That's fair. I think that's what we're all coming out on. It's I am kind of of the same opinion, and I think Nick made that abundantly clear that he's kind of out on it as a commander, too. So that's fair. So 99 is great, commander less so, but otherwise, all in all, makes for a pretty cool card, I have to say. All right, so now we'll be moving on to some of Nick's points. So Nick had some ideas. He's been listening to our podcast and listening to us, share our ideas about how to make commander fun and engaging for everyone. And he's got a little bit of, he's got some ideas he wants to sort of share with us. So I think, Nick, do you want to, like, where is the genesis of this sort of discussion coming from?
The genesis of the thought process is partly that I loathe sacred cows. Anything that people talk about in circles and presume to be true or reasonable, I distaste. And when you see, so I genuinely feel like card advantage, as discussed in Commander, has been stretched beyond the point of utility. When people use words like virtual card advantage or simulated card advantage or kind of sort of card advantage. Maybe the term is inappropriate. And I think the important half of card advantage very much is advantage, not the sliver of cardboard in your hand. And so it started me thinking about how does card advantage function? Because it is a very applicable and important concept to the game, most especially in 1v1 play. To zoom out broadly, card advantage is, in the game of Magic, Magic is an asymmetrical, imperfect information game, as opposed to chess being a symmetrical, perfect information game. You didn't bring the same pieces I did, and you don't know what I'm going to be playing on any given turn. So, card advantage being one of the resources that have parity. In a 1v1 setting, you both have the same, both players have equal life. They will draw the same amount of cards on any given point, at any given point in the game, and will have had the same number of opportunities to have put land into play at that point in the game. And this breaks down once you arrive at playing a game of Commander. It's not parity at any point in the game. It's disingenuous to, and dubious to try and compare a single player at a table to the sum total of the opponents. The game is not played as arch enemy. You are playing against the opponents, but not explicitly 1v3. And so I think card advantage as a concept fails in this setting.
All right. Makes sense. Up to this point, you're making sense. All right. So you're right. Like, to talk about the true idea of card advantage is probably doing Commander players a disservice, because it is far more nuanced than just outcarding your opponent the way you can in a 1v1 game. All right. And so in that sense, you're absolutely correct to this point. I don't think anybody would take exception to that. So, all right. So
even going down the rabbit hole of card advantage in the game of 1v1 Magic, if I use a bounce spell, it's not card advantage, correct?
No, I would say it's not. It's the tempo advantage.
Exactly. So in this setting, is removal effectively the same as a bounce card because of the prevalence of use of graveyard recursion? We just talked about Duretti quite conveniently. That card enables the recursion of many things out of the graveyard quite trivially. And so, does destroying something turn into simply a stronger bounce and a tempo advantage as opposed to genuinely being removal? So I think even in those classic metrics of how card advantage functions, when you have four players, of which likely more than one will be intending to try and utilize all of the zones within the game, it fails even further and harder to generate lines of thought that lead to advantage. And so I started thinking about how and what provides that advantage, and how could you describe the advantage? And I arrived at two thought processes: resource advantage and strategic advantage. Resource advantage is straightforward enough: land, cards, permanence in play, options available to you would fall into the category more of strategic advantage, or doing things that your opponents are incapable of responding to or less capable of responding to, as well as the sorts of loops that Duretti would lead to. If someone can't in that moment respond, it doesn't matter if they could dig for an answer, you might just end the game then and there.
All right. I'm still with you.
Okay. All right. So, now, how do you gain that advantage? A value engine. Having watched you play, you know you most certainly enjoy yourself a good value engine.
Who, me? You're talking to me?
Me? Yeah. You.
Yeah, you're right. you're absolutely correct. I think that inherently when I sit down to build a deck, I do look at trying to build a value engine somewhere. And, you know, oftentimes I perhaps am guilty of looking to try and build a value engine through my commander. And I think a lot of players are looking, like, when we are looking to evaluate commanders, we are looking to evaluate it based on, can we generate some sort of advantage and a value engine through whatever our commander is choosing to do. I think there are very few commanders out there that people build regularly that are just there to give you access to colors. Like you're usually building because it has something to do, so to speak.
And I think that that is a very good choice. At the same time, I've also come to the realization that without redundancy, if you are relying too heavily on a unique effect within the command zone, you may hamstring yourself within the game. So a value engine, but perhaps one that you are able to produce a redundant effect for. So when I say something that is unique, King Darien of Kel'Jor is an example of too unique to be replicated. Whenever damage is dealt to a play to the controlling player, you make that many 1/1 soldiers. If you have a single life-gaining creature, you can only be killed if you are dealt lethal damage in a single instance of damage.
All right, really? Hold on. Can we read Darien, King of Kel'Jor?
Yeah.
So everyone can. So 4WW, 3/3 legendary creature, human soldier. Whenever you're dealt damage, you may create that many 1/1 white soldier creature tokens. So
pair this with a soul sister, and you may not, unless an instance of damage exceeds your life total, you would put as many soldiers as you were dealt damage into play, gaining that life back. If you have two soul sisters, you gain twice the damage that was dealt to you. You become unkillable through damage.
All right.
Really super, super cool. But if it's removed, you're euchred. The deck falls apart. I looked at building this and I thought, wow, that's incredibly fun. Too unique. You can't build that value engine, that value of you can't even kill me unless you do it all at once without him. And people will remove it.
It's the first thing you remove in that deck. Like it's the first target. Because I recognize that I'm not going to be able to punch through very readily until it is off the table and now so expensive that you can't ever replay it.
An example of a value engine in the command zone that you might be able to create redundancy for is something like Zada or Feather. There's similar-ish effects where you can recycle the spells you are using. It's kind of a value engine, kind of recursion, and this is the resource advantage combined with strategic advantage, and you could call it card advantage. They're frustratingly nebulous in that regard, that it depends on what cards you're holding as to whether or not it is strategic or a resource. I think it is more strategic because you're holding up the answers, and you actually have to forecast them turn on turn to your opponent for Feather, at least, as to how you can protect that piece in the game. And Zada with Mirror Wing, you can create similar effects, and there are other pieces that you can layer into that to create large, incredible swings with.
Okay. Can I just hold us up for a second? Because I think you did a really good job of breaking down some of the engines that are available to people, and sort of likening them to like sort of lumping them together in some effects, so people can sort of see the examples that you've created writ large for your idea of a value engine that can be created. So you had things like things that require little to no investment on your end, but have significant and effect that amplify your strategy. That's how you phrased it when you shipped it to me. And I think that's probably a very, very apt way of describing that. So you had some cards you sort of lumped together. So you had Zada and Feather, which duplicate instants and sorceries to, you know, create an overwhelming advantage. Feather exiles it, so it sort of emulates white drawing additional cards. Red allows you to basically fork these instants across your team, presumably to allow for a massive attack, or for other effects, I suppose. But
there's enough other effects.
Yeah. So like they're similar in nature in that sense. Then you had things like Panharmonicon and Yarok and Tessa Karlov, who are playing with a certain sort of effect and will double it. So Panharmonicon and Yarok is kind of they're basically two peas in the same pod. But Tessa, well, Tessa Karlov ends up being like the death triggers. She's death Panharmonicon. So those are like some obvious. Like those commanders just have to sit on the board and they do something gross, and you know you're looking then to use these and leverage that to further and amplify your own strategy to put the game out of reach so you can outvalue your opponent through the advantage generated. So I think you summed that up really, really nicely. But there are some others here that I mean people may not think about that I think also bear mentioning.
So I had included any Enchantress deck is by virtue of its construction a value engine. You're playing a bunch of small, very interchangeable pieces that will accumulate a snowballing value. And this one's very much decentralized by comparison, where at least half a dozen enchantresses are available to you. You want to get one or two or three, and just start pulling as many cards off the top and stack enchantments and just go nuts, right? So those triggers as cast triggers then become the resource within that build, because you are going to have other things that are looking for enchantments, and it is the snowballing value engine. And you added the lithiform engine to the notes, and I would actually argue that goes into doublers.
Perhaps I put it in there because I think I liken the lithiform engine and Helm of the Host not so much as doublers, but as things that are similar to Panharmonicon in effect. Because like I don't think you're using the third mode where you're looking to duplicate a permanent spell, which is kind of what doublers do. They're looking to double the number of counters or tokens or something. But Panharmonicon and Yarok are looking to copy a triggered effect, and I think based on the way Lithiform Engine plays, based on my limited chance to play it, which I've only played it a couple of times, is that you want to copy the effect more so than the permanent. So when something enters the battlefield, you want to duplicate that effect. So that's why I kind of likened it here. It's another engine of that. So that nature. I think Helm of the Host sort of fits in the same. You're generating value with this equipment to create tokens of stuff. So I think they sort of fit in this, to my mind, to my thinking, they sort of go in here too.
Fair enough. So that then dovetails into doublers, which is effects like Anointed Procession and Wound Reflection and Double Vision, or if you want it in the command zone, Kalamax, or Riku of Two Reflections.
And these are going to be looking for Anointed Procession is going to be looking for any token entering the battlefield. And I think with the Lithiform engine, and if you were playing it in a Yarak deck, that turns the creature entering the battlefield with an ETB trigger into a copied permanent, and then you double that, you're tripling the effect of that incoming permanent. I mean, the mana investment becomes intense, but that does a heck of a lot real quick, depending on what ETB you're trying to get going. And Anointed Procession is an obscenely expensive card for a good reason, just like doubling Season and Parallel Lives. They lead to very egregious board states quickly, which is the resource advantage that will put a big smile on your face.
Fair enough. No,
go ahead.
No, I was just like, the doublers, no argument here. Like things like that, like you're doubling spells effects, or like create multiples of the effect without you know a lot of extra work. So Calamax does it. But Thousand Year Storm can do it too if you're prepared to invest in a six mana enchantment, which is also equally very, very powerful. And then you like the ones that the token generators are the ones we all think about off the top: Anointed Procession, Parallel Lives, even Doubling Season, which is absurd in its own right. So yeah, no, these doublers like these are always generating advantage and resources for sure. And you're right. Like I think coming back to like the main thesis is that it's not as simple as just drawing cards. These are creating resources for us to utilize on the battlefield, without actually ensuring that we draw additional cards at any point. So yeah. I just want to keep that in mind. Like that's the premise. That's the premise here. Like we need to make sure that we need to do a better job as Commander players of coming back to this idea that it's not just generating card advantage. We need to generate resources that we can then leverage to greater effect. And so you may have a deck that doesn't draw cards, and but you're not inherently disadvantaged if you have other ways of generating resources and advantage. And that's, I think, really what you're coming back to.
Yes, and I think one of the important things to think about as a game wears on, we are playing the format that will have the longest turn count. As the game wears on, everyone is drawing more cards over the duration of the game, and the effect of drawing nominal extra cards is mitigated more. It is by percent smaller effect over a 10-turn game than if you were playing a 5-turn game. It's half as effective to simply draw one or two or three cards.
You're right.
That if you are not drawing large sums of cards and doing a good amount of card selection, it's hardly even worth being hyper-concerned with single instances of the words draw a card.
Fair, because I mean you're absolutely right. Even single instances of saying things that say draw a card are insufficient to cantrips, for instance, are inefficient ways to draw you anything in a game of Commander where you're inherently behind on cards because your opponents have drawn collectively more cards than you will have, even if this Defiant Strike draws you one, your opponents are you've drawn two for your turn. Congrats, but your opponents are now generated, at least three, if not more.
Yeah, and I think also being able to not waste your single target removal. So you always have to hold up mana if you're holding an answer. And some of the on-the-board resources offer you the option to not waste that mana you've held up. They offer you a way to use it to create an advantage if you don't have to use that card to instantly react to your opponents.
Okay. All right.
I know you love effect density on cards. So when you see something like your instant speed answer, it's even better when you can have it as an optional instant speed answer. So this is all the charms. And I think Wizards has been pushing more of these, right? So you were talking about the dual modal,
the MDSCs, multiple double face cards.
Yes.
Modal double face cards, yes.
Mouthful cards.
Yeah.
And I look forward to seeing more of those because they've said that they are going to be printing them into standard for the next little bit. And that's exciting.
I think Kaldheim's going to get some more too. So yeah, like they're going to get them for a couple of sets in here. But yeah, I think you're right. So I think you're calling it effect density, where so cards, multiple cards that will have multiple modes so that when you go and look for a particular effect, you have the effect, even if it's not particularly efficient at what it does. Charms, commands, you have adventure cards, which have got multiple modes on them, fuse cards, aftermath cards, even things like evoke cards, like creatures that have an effect. And then you can, like your, the little blue one that we all love to play is
Muldrifter.
And so there you've got your, essentially what's a divination on one half, and then you can get a divination and a 2/2 if you're prepared to pay full price. So like,
yeah,
like I don't necessarily call those effect density, but I do call them flexibility, where I can, or built in 2-for-1s, where I can, these cards inherently have something on them where I'm looking to do stuff. You're right. Like I love my charms, particularly the 2-colored ones from Return to Ravnica block. I think those are terrific. I'm less enthused about the 3-color ones from elsewhere because they're 3 colors and go in just decidedly fewer decks, and I find those end up getting cut because the mana requirement makes them suitably prohibitively expensive to cast, that I don't really want to cast them. But you're right, fuse cards or aftermath cards. I think aftermath cards are sorely neglected because I think those are those are terrific additions that people don't play enough of.
I just need to point out for the one moment here, the deeply ingrained concept of a 2-for-1 for you.
You're right. Yes, I do.
Which is part of why I wanted to have this conversation. It's embedded in the mind of anyone who's played reasonably competitive Magic, and it falls on its face in this format. It's not a 2-for-1. It's you're both down. It's a bounce spell. Think of it. Think of your removal as effectively a tempo spell, because compared to the rest of the table, it has that effect.
I don't know. Like some of these cards, I don't necessarily buy that, because I mean, I don't think you're particularly some of these cards. Like, so I would agree that the fuse cards and evoke cards and charms, yes, that is a tempo play. But I think the aftermath cards and adventure cards are actually very, very different, in the sense that you can play the front half and then you get to play a secondary effect later. So in the adventure cards, you play a spell, the adventure part, and then you still get a body out of it. So you're not actually, I don't think you're actually tempoing yourself, because you're not burning the resource. Like, you still have access to a spell that is going to essentially put you in a position where you still have a virtual card in hand that you can then leverage.
It's better than a single virtual card in hand. It is a card that is in a zone that is the most impossible to interact with and in no way takes up space in your hand.
And this is true.
And I think the adventure cards are, I very much like them. And for many reasons. Among that, you can search for a sorcery or a creature, or an instant or a creature, and pull them out of your deck on either one of those and bring them to your hand and then cast either half of it. And that's partly why I put the heading in as effect density on that particular card, were you to draw it, you have two effects. It's more than simply two choices. It's both choices. Right? All right. That's Aftermath and...
Yeah. Nick, you good? Uh-oh. Nick got dropped.
No, that's Nick. Not good.
No, not good at all. He was on a roll. You went away there for a minute. Can you hear me? Nick, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah.
You got me?
Yeah, I've had you the whole time.
Oh, good, because we lost you there for a minute.
Cool.
Not really, but anyway, it's normal. I blame the gremlins.
So, another version of effect density is recursion. So, mm-hmm. So we played a game, and I played Dakon, which is a zombie knight who allows you to cast any knight from your graveyard. That recursion piece, that single card's effect density of letting me recast those same spells again and again was the only reason I won a game that I had no business with. A single exile effect were to occur and I would have simply lost. Recurrable pieces, and Feather actually fits into this as well, are effect density, where you can do things again and again and again, and it falls into these annoying play patterns where you're predictably doing similar things. But that can be very effective if it cannot be answered. And the last piece of effect density, I guess, is perhaps dubious to be in this category, is cheating costs. So the density of your actual mana resource, turn over turn. Playing Golos is rather fun, especially when you spin off the top and actually get three things worth having hit the board. It's hit and miss. There's also things like the Hideaway lands, which I love playing, where they come into play. You look at the top four cards of your library, you hide one of those cards underneath it, and then once you fulfill a condition, if you're curious, the blue and black ones are effectively unfulfillable in Commander, but red, green, white are achievable and frankly relatively easy at times. Then you get to cast whatever is under it for a single mana,
which sounds delightful.
Oh, buddy.
Sounds delightful.
So go ahead.
Well, what you're describing is the reason people want to play reanimator strategies is you go and dump your big nasty scary thing in the bin and then cheat it back into play with a much cheaper reanimation spell. So,
the important thing is, so I loathe playing reanimator strategies. They just, for me, are frustratingly hit or miss. You have giant things and you have reanimation packages, and if those don't coalesce and line up and you don't get the right things into the bin, it just doesn't work. The little ways that you can do small things, I think it's a case of looking at the floor instead of the ceiling. And so reanimators do that, but it can be done in little ways in most decks. And I think that's an important thing to look at. Yeah. So I think going back to the beginning of discussing what resources have parity is important. We have cards, we have lands for turn, and we have a life total. Right? Yep. We all, in this format, start with the same number of cards in our deck. So that's actually a point of parity in this format that isn't expected as necessarily parity in other formats.
So, yeah, like you could have situations, for instance, now with Yorion, that you have 80 card decks playing 60 card decks.
Yeah. And so in our format, in Commander, that will not occur. It's 100 cards, right? If you have a companion, it's one of your 100.
Yep.
Partners, there's two in the command zone and 98 elsewhere. So that becomes a point of parity that isn't inherently a point of parity elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So focusing on those resources of the cards in hand, life total, library, and land for turn, right? Everyone has always heard ramp. Confounding conundrum, as you talked about last week. I feel like it should have been printed in white, but I guess it goes into blue-white stacks decks now too.
Yes, I'm imagining it does quite happily.
So if you're going to attack other resources than your opponent's life in this game, right? So there's a lot of life, right? 120 opponent life. So we can, in that blue-white stacks deck, choose to run a aggressive mill package, because mill is something that is being scaled fantastically for Commander. And go ahead.
Well, like I would agree. I think they've done more and more in the last little while about milling multiple targets with a single spell. And Maddening Cacophony is just like sort of among the reaches of the pinnacle of it, because it's traumatized, but like for the whole table instead of just one target. So I think you're onto something there. People are picking up on this idea that it's, there as being something that they're looking to develop this segment of the game.
Yeah, and I also would encourage everyone to find one or two cards that, for whatever deck you're playing, that bounce back to your library, just to try and vex those mill players as best as possible. Hey, it's important to remember that everything in this game has its own form of counterplay, and it's important to not turn our noses up at that.
No,
destruction and discard included.
No, I was going to get to that, because that was something. Looking at your assessment of attacking, Nick has labeled this as being attacking other resources apart from just your opponent's life totals, because arguably the 120 life that your opponents are each have at the start of the game is something that's probably going to be the most preserved and most difficult attribute to target and eliminate. They're going to defend their life total at all costs.
I would encourage everyone to actually try and bolster their life total. We talk all the time about ramp and card draw. No one says try and gain life. It's effective.
Well, it is, and it's what it does is it what it means is that you can't you is it is more difficult to knock you out of the game, meaning you get an extra draw step or two or three or four just by virtue of the fact your life total has been padded by whatever. Now, I will argue that there are decks that don't care anymore. I think depending on what power level you're choosing to play, even in the casual sphere, there is a very real dilemma that is starting to emerge more and more, that that there are decks and strategies that are so strong that the condition to be played that essentially make them you just cannot surmount them is rising all the time, because I'll just give you an example of a card that I have played against and I have played it myself, but it's Debt to the Deathless, and it's a very powerful Orzhov colored drain spell, and we'll read it out loud, and because it's fairly mild in terms of this effect, but X and then white, white, black, black. Each opponent loses 2x X life. You gain life equal to this life lost this way. So for this card to be good, the condition being met is very, very low. And like if you pad a life total, it may not matter because you just get drained out for a million and your game is over regardless. Torment of Hellfire sort of falls in the same vein. Or, you know, almost any giant X spell will do it. But I find that there are more and more of them that are, you know, circulating out there and in more of the color combinations to make it such that we need to be mindful of out there. So, but padding life is a very effective way, particularly to set back a, you know, a mid-range or a, you know, moderately aggressive strategy, because now they have to, instead of doing 40 points to damage to you to kill you, they have to do 45 or 50 or 55 points. And that's a lot. That's a much stiffer test when you also consider the other players at the table.
Well, and I also think that viewing it as, so there's, like other things, you can gain life in little dribs and drabs, or you can build it so that it is a primary or secondary objective within the deck you're playing, just like a landfall deck or an aristocrat's deck or like Zyrus or Nekusar, a card draw deck.
Yeah, a wheel deck.
Yeah, so you can make it a more primary focus and turn it up to 11, and it's more than that padded life total. It becomes a total that is effectively insurmountable.
Yeah.
Anyway. But you are correct. There are plenty of ways. I was looking at cards yesterday that said have target player's life total, which doesn't really care what the number is. It's half what it was.
Yep.
So in games where we've played and I had a triple digit life total, what was your first go-to? Commander damage. You looked at the board state and you said, well, that's not happening. And you went hard to try and do commander damage.
I don't recall this. I don't usually use commander damage, but anyway, did I?
Shooting you, and you had been you had been handcuffed for the entire game by a curse, which was joyous. Coincidentally, just a fantastic Curse of Echoes. Fun card. My God, I enjoyed seeing that on the table.
Let's see. Curse of Echoes, because I have forgotten this. Obviously blank this from my mind. Blank. Curse of Echoes. Let's see this. Four and a blue. Enchant player. Whenever enchanted player casts an instant or sorcery spell, each other player may copy that spell and may choose new targets for the copy they control. Okay.
So yeah. This one is a really fun one for targeting the spell slinger at the table. There's someone who you expect to put down that very large Torment of Hailfire, because the copy goes on the stack before the original. And you would actually, so if they cast it, the person who's last in turn priority would be the one who casts their Torment of Hailfire first. If for whatever reason they chose to cast a Torment of Hailfire with them under the curse.
Commander. So what you? Yeah. Okay.
Anyway,
so this is nasty. I understand.
Yeah. So, commander damage, I think, although not something that everyone always walks into the game thinking, I'm going to win using this. At very least, it's important to know whether your deck can do that. If you have to shift gears and try and execute that strategy, can you, or is it just a complete non-bow?
Right. Okay. Gotcha.
And even if you can't do it with a commander, if you run,
I got it. Like everything you're saying makes a ton of sense here. Everything's making sense here. And I don't think Yeah, like I think you and I are all more or less on the same wavelength here. So commander damage is a great avenue to knock somebody down. If you cannot destroy their massive life total, get doing them 21, which isn't going to change, is a much easier option if they've got 150 life, right?
Absolutely.
Which is also why on the next point up here you put is infect damage, which is, you know, even more aggressive in the sense that it's only 10 instead of 21.
Yeah.
For exactly the same reasoning, which makes sense, right? Like if you can't beat them at 150 points of life because they've firesonged the Sunspeaker for 1,000,000, now but infect doesn't care. So anyway,
I think an important thing to consider, looking at all of the alternative win conditions that you could ever possibly think about, and having at least one available to you in your decks as a secondary backup. If plan A goes wrong, what is plan B? And even if it isn't infect or commander damage, or bolstering your life total so that you might as well be playing a game so long that it was a stacks game, you can always play the janky win condition cards, the Felidar Sovereigns and the Simic Ascendancy type cards that will simply win the game. And the first time I looked at these, I thought about it, and realize that in most games, you never actually win. You are simply the only person who didn't lose.
I suppose, yeah. No, like, I would, yeah. No, I could make that argument, yeah.
So, for once in your life, try and win a game, for heaven's sakes, instead of being the only person to not lose.
Fair enough.
Admittedly, so alternative win conditions can sometimes just be straight up a combo, right? So I've got Jace or Lab Man and a Leveler, which is a combo where I play, you know, one, the Jace or Lab Man's on the table, I play the Leveler, my library's gone, I went to draw a card, oops, I win. And that's maybe trivializing how protecting it and implementing it and bringing both cards to hand isn't necessarily easy. Combos are a legitimate way to win the game. Simply make sure to talk to everyone you're playing with before you have game-ending combos that simply just end the game sight unseen unless someone stops you. Because would love something like that, right, Lux?
I think we know Lux's answer to that one. Lux hates those combos are not Lux's friends. Not Lux's friend. All right. So that's, Oh, you're good. I got you. Can you hear me? Nick, are you still there? Uh-oh.
And technical difficulties.
So,
yeah. Yeah, anyway, yeah, go ahead, Nick. Nick.
Hello?
Yeah, I got you. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. So
okay.
The last piece of playing with, not necessarily fixating on the cards in your hands, is the cards in your opponent's hands. When you're playing in a multiplayer format, if you don't have to remove the threat on the table because your other opponent removed it, well, it's not card advantage, but the threat's gone and you wasted absolutely no resources. Like, that's the best spell you could cast. Use
yes.
the table. Work the table. Make
yes. deals. And there's definitely something that needs to be done. Some work that people need to do in that regard. That I think people have forgotten or don't feel as comfortable doing, but using the table as a resource to help you limit how much of yours you expend is ultimately a very key aspect of winning the game as well, right? So,
and right. I admittedly playing online a bunch, it's different than when we're playing in your basement and I know you and you know me and we've played games before. You're playing with someone who you don't know, and it's different. And I think a good many people have reservations about trying to make a deal because they're at times worried that someone's just going to screw them and win the game. I genuinely hope that people want to make those political plays that make this an actually interactive social game, as opposed to the optimal play at every turn because winning is most important. I think that is the essence of Commander, is making sure that you're all having fun and sometimes removing the stacks piece that's locking one player out of the game, even though it doesn't have an immediate benefit for you, might just be the right choice.
Makes sense. Which sort of comes back to a more philosophical point, which we'll have to have, I think, Nick on to explore a little bit more another time. So I think this has been a really good discussion to around the idea of resources and trying to change the way we think about it. Because you're right, we have spent a lot of time in the Commander world really delving into this idea of card advantage. I think you did a really nice job of laying it out there as being more than just card advantage. It's generating resources that you can leverage to an advantage generally, and going through how to then utilize it, and sort of some different ways of looking at it, which I think is a very helpful discussion for us to go into and provide for our audience. I think that's really, really in depth. So that's terrific. Lux, is there anything you wanted to jump in here and say something here? Like, I know Nick and I have sort of monopolized the floor here for a bit, but is there anything you wanted to jump into? Any ideas here that you don't jive with how you sort of see the game, or things that we've perhaps overlooked?
And honestly, I can't really think of anything, because you know my play style. It just depends. Either I just want to get the game completely in my favor, or I just want to stall it out.
Well, yes, I think actually your way of playing does fit in here with quite a bit of what Nick has been talking about, because a number of your decks, Lux, your Abzan and your Naya stuff that you like to build, inherently suffer from the classic definition of quote-unquote card advantage, because card advantage is generally only generated in blue if we're looking at it in the classical sense. But the way using Nick's paradigm of how we're looking at generating advantage, your Naya deck with Samet suddenly gets put under a whole new microscope as being not just something that is viable, but suddenly far more resilient a deck than people would initially give it credit for until they see it in action. So I actually really like the way Nick has framed it, because I think whether you know it or not, Lux, I think a lot of what you build in your decks is emulated by this way of thinking that that Nick is presenting here. So I think you two guys are on the same wavelength, whether you know it or not. So I think there's a lot of good to be had from this sort of discussion. I would cite, the one thing that I would bring up is the fact that the choosing a different route of attack is, I think, probably underutilized, I think I would argue, by most players, because of the fact that we are often so predicated on doing the thing our deck wants to do, when having another way to get there Even if it's just you put in, you know, a Revel in Riches, or you put in the, I don't know, whatever the other alternate win condition is that you want to play with, as another mode that you can flip to if you get stuck, I think is probably couldn't be stressed more than you know, I think we've done tonight, because I think enough players don't build it and then probably ought to be. So
it's the difference between wanting to be right about how your deck works and wanting to be effective about how your deck works.
Agreed. And sometimes you got to swallow a little pride, and like what works is sometimes not the prettiest, but gets the job done, so to speak. All right, so let's move on to his deck tonight, because we've got a pretty spicy deck here. So, Nick, tonight your deck you brought with us is Marici, Breaker of the Coil, which is a very interesting card, because I've never actually seen this card in play in the wild. So, one red, white, green for a 5/4 legendary creature, Cat Warrior. And then it says, your opponents can't cast spells during combat. And whenever a creature you control deals damage to a player, goad each creature that player controls, which is a super interesting effect. The mass goad effect is super fun. So talk us through this there, Nick. What's your thought process here?
So I think Marici is a trap for most people's first read on how to build him. You look at it and you think, oh, wow, I can put all these sneaky, evasive things together and all my opponents are going to just slug each other to, you know, most of the way to death. And then I'll just come in to finish the job off. I genuinely think that when you're building this deck, you need to be able to finish a player toe-to-toe or you're just never going to take a game. And you also have to expect to not necessarily have Marici. So you.
Well, yes, I'm thinking this Marici is the sort of card that gets targeted and killed from the outset, because if you allow your opponents to be goaded into having them attack all over the place, they're going to find that they don't like that and that they're going to kill it.
Well, yeah, or they've brought a deck that doesn't really care at all about combat, and they're either not going to be an effective tool for you to use to beat your opponent with your other opponent with, or they want their pieces, like an Aristocrat's build, to not die in combat. So, yeah, it will be targeted, is my read on Marici. It looks fun, but it's probably not going to stick. So earlier in the episode, I had brought up things like King Darien, and I really love that card, but I don't think it belongs as the commander, partly because of color access, partly because its strategy is particularly narrow. So in the creature suite, I've brought things that make tokens. Darien or the Honored Hydra, the Ant Queen, Tristani, there's that life gain that I'm particularly excited about, with Proliferate. And there's a lot of tokens in this. So sometimes people will refer to tokens as that virtual card advantage. It's a resource. They're bodies on the board. And you can make more of them and more of them and more of them. Well, really, that's why wouldn't you? So with all of those tokens coming into play, I've included 6 different creatures that will, no, yes, 6 different creatures that are going to get life whenever another creature enters the battlefield under my control. And that's that snowballing small life gain. This is like ramping a little in most decks, as opposed to it being like a landfall deck where you're ramping constantly. No, it's just a little padding of the life total, because I'm trying to make everyone fight to the death. So I expect that it'll be swung at me whenever possible. One of the cards I've included in the creature suite. So the rule for me when building this wasn't the normal Epic Experiment cards from Return to Ravnica forward. I gave myself latitude, knowing that my restriction was I don't want to see the words draw a card on any card anywhere at all. Except Spirit of the Labyrinth, which coincidentally says each player can't draw more than one card each turn.
Okay.
And that's, you've had the conversation about hate bears. If it's a hate bear and it kind of slides into your strategy, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we've talked about that here on the show before.
Yeah. So, very much wanting to try and control combat. Maurice says, you're going to try and... So, I'm making a ton of tokens. I'm going to hopefully get through by simply outnumbering my opponent. That's partly my plan. Or using effects like Audric, the master tactician, who is a 2 generic, 2 white... 3/4 soldier for a strike whenever Audric, Master Tactician, and at least 3 other creatures attack. You choose which creatures block this combat and how those creatures block. Or you could use something like Bedlam that just says creatures can't block. Enchantment that I just love. Or you could use Invasion Plans that... each creature blocks whenever able. So hopefully... Oh, and the attacking creature chooses how each creature blocks. So you're going to set up the blocks to be utterly most beneficial as possible.
Right.
And there's more than a few of those types of effects throughout. So we're going to make a bunch of little creatures. We're going to try and populate them. But it's pretty wasteful trying to populate one ones up, I think. So yep. Wherever possible, I have tried to produce the bigger creature tokens when I can. And this is through cards like the Stone Idol Trap or the Advent of the Worm, a 5/5 worm with trample on an instant spell. So you can play the Selesnya Worm at flash speed and then later in the turn cycle. Or Reese the Redeemed and Second Harvest are good ways to double down. So this is what I was talking about earlier, where you want to hold up your instant speed answers and you're holding your mana. Come the end of the turn cycle, you might not have had to respond. And normally it's very bizarre to hold up 4, 5, 6 mana. If you have pieces in play that mean that at instant speed, you can react after everyone else has taken their priority right before your turn and double your creature tokens or scry 2 or dig down in your library or create a token, these kinds of things that are recurrable effects on a permanent allow you to play at instant speed better, even though you're not drawing cards. And then you're more conservative about your instant speed answers because it's not that bad feeling of I had to hold open mana and didn't use it. Again, right. And again, and again, which sucks. One of the pieces of ramp in this that I'm most excited about is Harvest Season. It is a 2 and a green sorcery speed. Search your library for up to X basic lands, where X is the number of tapped creatures you control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one. And people forget about it. Often forgotten about and is very, very
good. I've never cast it searching for less than 5 lands.
And does it put them right into play? It does, doesn't it?
Popped. So I only have 2 board wipes in this deck, and most people wouldn't have even looked at them and said, golly, that's a board wipe.
Okay, let's go have a look at your list. Now you got me interested. Like, what are our wipes tonight? Well, I would argue that... let's see. Oh, that's a good question. What is your board wipes? I don't know. What is it?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Descent of Dragons and Fight to the Death are the only two board wipe-ish cards. So Descent of the Dragons, you're not going to kill everything. You're going to kill the things that need to die. Where
right.
And if I have 1/1s laying around, we are at parity for I'll destroy as many 1/1s of my own, or if I have more than you, I'll destroy more of them and convert them into 4/4 flying dragons and remove whatever you have that is vexing me.
Gotcha.
Other one is the cheapest board wipe you could want, which is Fight to the Death. So if I'm goading my opponents and using things like Fight to the Death, instant speed, red, white, destroy all blocking creatures and all blocked creatures.
Yes, so, that would do it.
With all of the things that I'm so Master Warcraft, where you control combat, you can use it together. Or if Marisi has goaded someone, you are going to do your best to efficiently remove as much as possible. But you don't right. necessarily in this deck want all of the creatures gone. You want to be able to pick out the ones that you can't let kill you.
Right.
Because all those right. creatures are your resource. They are your resource if they are killing your opponents.
Gotcha. Oh, that makes sense.
Anyways, that's, I think, the highlight reel of the Soul Foundry is the last card that I would like to point out that I utterly love. So long as it's not legendary, turn on turn, you can copy whatever. Admittedly, you have to pay its mana cost as well as the 4 to originally exile it. But you can start copying those life gain pieces, or you could. The real dream is to get the Hornet's Nest underneath the Soul Foundry. And then you can have a 0/2 that turns into however many 1/1s with Death Touch that you just took damage. It has a similar deterrent effect as Kindarian would be, where you don't want to attack because it's just constantly going to turn into a worse situation when you do.
Gotcha. No, that's probably spicy. I really like that. Ooh. I don't think I've ever seen that card. But anyway, that's a cool card. I like it. I like it a lot. No, it's a cool deck, Lux. You're the resident Naya tokens guy. What do you think?
Man, I think it's pretty cool.
I think that's fun. I like the fact that you took an idea and including the not drawing more cards and still demonstrated the ability to generate a significant amount of advantage through other means, which is I think is actually really, really useful and something that people often forget. So no, I am a big fan. I like it. That's fun. All right. So here's what I think. Do we want to, I have a couple of questions here that we normally do our segment 4. That would be, you know, our look at Dominaria. Do you want to answer a couple of them and then call it a night? Okay. Let's do a couple of those. All right. So here's a couple of questions that I've drummed up here. So, we got 3 of us on tonight, so it might be a good spot. So what commander that you have built do you think best represents you as a Magic the Gathering player? So I'll give you guys a chance to think about it. I'm going to go first here. So
now,
go ahead.
From any set or Dominaria?
Any set. It can be any set. So I think the commander that's out there that I think it would represent what I want to do when I play commander is probably Yarok, the Desecrated, because I love the idea of having my built-in value engine. I love the access to the raw might of green. You get the protection and interaction of black and blue. And then you have the ability to generate significant amounts of value. And I think that's more than anything I want to draw. I want to generate value out of every element of my game when I sit down to play. And decks I build, I would argue that's probably, you know, the overwhelming focus of what it is I want to do. for better or for worse. So I would say, like, one that represents me the best is Yarok, even though I don't have a Yarok deck yet. So it's on the list of decks to build, and it just hasn't got there yet. Lux, what about you?
And honestly, and you probably see this one coming, but I really think that the one that describes me the most has to be Anofenza the Foremost.
And why? Like, talk us through a little bit why you think she... Like, I would agree. I don't think you're wrong, but I want to know, like, what are you thinking? What is the thought there?
Well, it's in mostly, like, a two-parter. Like, it's the color identity, like, Obzon. Like, just think about, like, all the things that that gives you access to. And then there's also, like, the plus one counter thing. And they, as you've heard me say before, especially in the Lotus Council chat, I'm all about just completely beefing up my creatures.
No, I've heard you comment the fact that you love to pump your dudes and make them and take them out of range of being dealt with on the battlefield, and you love getting into the red zone. So I can see that. I can see Anofenza being just right in your wheelhouse. I agree.
Yeah, they, not only does she beef up your creatures and herself, but the color identity, like, it gives you access to, like, removal, graveyard recursion, like, life gain, all that jazz.
No, you're absolutely right. It does a lot of the things that we've been talking about that we want to do anyway. You know, and many of the things that we talked about tonight right on the show. So I think you're not wrong. And there, Nick, what about you?
I would say I think Estrid the Masked is who I would choose. Partly the color access is... I strongly identify with the Bant color access. I live in the woods. I have fields around me, and we all die without water. Her effects are the most tantalizing to me. I love playing Enchantress builds, and to be able to untap each thing that you have placed an enchantment on gets broken quickly. And we all like our broken toys. So
that's true.
As well as her having a built-in means to place an enchantment on any type of permanent. Like, you could leave the ultimate off of her and I'd play her till the end of time. Her ultimate's pretty good too.
Yeah. That where they all hop back out of the graveyard, if I'm not mistaken?
All the enchantments just right back in play. And anyways, yeah, I love her. And the Morisi deck we looked at this evening is not that dissimilar. But once you get access to blue, you get a few... you can make a copy of anything kind of cards, and good grief, copying the wrong thing and then populating the snot out of it is just fun.
I would agree. As someone who owns a Trustani deck and loves to populate Desolation Giant, or sorry, Desolation Twin, yes, I understand. I understand completely. All right, next question, last one, and then we'll sign off for the night because we've been going a long time. What is an underplayed commander that you want to build around? A whole bunch of us have got people. I've got commanders in the back of our brains that we'd love to build with. So, what do you think would be one that you'd want to build with? I should go ahead first. And this is going to sound absolutely absurd, but maybe not. But I want to build Phylath. I don't know sure if it's underplayed or not, but I think Phylath, the new red green commander from Zendikar Rising, is there's something about it that speaks to me in a way that I haven't had a commander speak to me in a little while. So 4 red green for a 5/5, and when Phylath World Sculptor enters the battlefield, create a 0/1 plant creature token for each basic land you control, and then whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, put 4+1+1 counters on target plant you control. And that, to me, there's just something there. I'm not sure if it truly be underrepresented, however, considering the propensity with which people are building Omnath and only Omnath, I think Phylath could qualify as being underrepresented. So that's my vote. So, Lux, what about you?
And of course, before I get to mine, And I just want to say that kind of funny you mentioned Phyleth, because that's one of the cards I pulled from my collector's pack.
Woo! Love that guy. So, yeah, no, for sure. That's a nice, that guy is good. All right, what do you think there, Lux?
And honestly, like, I'm just going down the list because I'm not sure which is underplayed.
Oh, there's so many, man. Like, it's just so many out there. Well, he's going. Have you got one in mind there, Nick?
Yeah. It's a Tayam or Tayam, the Luminance Enigma.
Yeah, no, that guy's good.
Hello?
I got you. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yes, so Tayam, the Luminance Enigma, is an underplayed, I think it's underplayed. It's fairly new. It only has 672 decks to its name, and I have struggled to build a Abzan deck that I enjoy playing. I won't let myself build more than a single deck in any color combination so that I don't start building into really, really tight patterns. So I think it has a lot of fun potential that I would be I spent a bit of time today actually trying to piece it together, and it seems like a puzzle I'll enjoy.
Sounds good. It looks like a lot of fun, but I agree. It's not as intuitive as some builds are right off the hop. Absolutely. All right, and Lux, what about you?
And honestly, in like seeing how many this one has, and like, I think Zerda the Dawnwaker would be pretty good.
Oh, infinite combo dot deck for you. We're getting you a basalt monolith, and we're just gonna just have at her, my friend.
Yep.
And then we're gonna find something gross to do with it. Maybe it's some fireballs, maybe it's some meteor, sort of some comet storms, or I don't know. You're just gonna make a whole lot of mana and just burn everybody out. I'm a fan. I approve. And Zerd is underappreciated, underloved. I agree. No, excellent. Good stuff. I love it. All right. So at this point there, guys, I think it's time for us to wrap up. We've had a long one tonight. We've been talking a long time. So we're going to move to wrap up this week's show. First off, foremost, a big thank you to Nick for coming on and going through in such deep depth and detail about a new or a different way of thinking about your decks and how to generate advantage and resources for your decks. So, Nick, if people wanted to get a hold of you, how could they get a hold of you?
They can't. If you would like to talk to me about this, the best way would be to at me or PM me or whatever, the direct message me on Discord. I'm Weirdums, Weirdums on the Lotus Council. Please, if you take issue with how I perceive the game, so long as it's not spurious, and I'd love to talk about it. Please, at me.
Sounds good. So if you want to get a hold of us here on the podcast, the easiest way for us is to either find us on find our email address at theepicexperimentpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at @EpicExpCast. That's us. Easiest way to get a hold of us. So by all means, if you want to talk to us more about what you heard tonight, you have ideas, you want to take exception to stuff, let us know. Also, all of our decks, including the deck that Nick shared this evening, will be up on the Moxfield account that we have at moxfield.com under the user The Epic Experiment Podcast, all one word. So if you get on the social media, ask us a question, leave us a comment, like, follow, subscribe to the cast. Every little bit helps to get the word out there and hearing and talking, that we are talking and all about Commander right here on the podcast each and every week. We'd love to hear from you. So, Don't wait. Next week, we are going to be starting some talk about probably about Commander Legends, because I think spoilers start happening next Monday. But then on top of it, we're also going to be delving into Dominaria and the awesome glory of the Commander goodness that is available to us there. But that is for next week. So until then, this is the Epic Experiment Podcast signing off. Wishing you all the best wherever you get to play Magic next. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Have yourselves a great week. We'll see you then.